Welcome to Climate Underground. I'm your host, Robert Thorson. Thanks for joining us. Episode 8, Deep Time. Humans are storytelling creatures. We especially like creation stories that explain who we are and where we came from. Before science, most stories were symbolic myths or creative fictions. Since the emergence of science, however, most creation stories are non-fiction narratives grounded in hard evidence. The hard evidence for geologists are the rocks. The hard evidence for credentialed historians is the catalog of written documents, census counts, commodity prices, tax lists, land deeds, territory maps, legal documents, and so forth. Moving back in time, such archival records eventually trickle down to zero in the ruins of ancient civilizations. The oldest writings, Egyptian hieroglyphics, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Norse runes, Mayan codexes, Mesopotamian cuneiform, these bridge the document-based histories of historians and the artifact-based prehistories of archaeologists. Beyond that, the oldest documents are Neolithic architectural monuments of early civilizations, Paleolithic projection points, the oldest bones of our species, Homo sapiens, dating to about 0.3 million years, and the oldest hand axes dating to 3.3 million years ago, and the oldest bones left on this side of the split with chimpanzees more than 5 million years ago. The increasing depth of time is offset by the progressive loss and fragmentation of the evidentiary record. Just as surely as archaeology provides the backstories of human technology and civilization, so too does the stratified archive of geology provide the backstory for Earth history and climate change. From this archive, we learn that the stepwise creation story of human culture was a stepwise consequence of climate change, ultimately driven by geothermal heat flow from the deep underground. The most definitive current text for the current climate crisis is the IPCC's report, AR6, The Physical Science Basis. It's grounded in terabytes of quantitative data collected by thousands of scientists using well-calibrated, accurate measuring devices deployed around the globe by satellites, monitoring stations, and on-site visits. We have gas-sniffing drones, oceanographic buoys, and borehole data loggers working 24/7 around the world. Proving rather than asserting that the Earth is actually warming was no small task, given the size and scope and complexity of what's being measured. Given this deluge of data, it's easy to forget that continuous and well-calibrated data for the concentration of atmospheric CO2 in the atmosphere extends no further back than 1958, the first year of the Keeling curve. Establishing that curve was an attempt to gain some control, what, over 1 year later, pioneering climate scientists Roger Revelle and Hans Suess described as perhaps the greatest geophysical experiment in history. The globally distributed continuous and quantitative meteorological records of temperature and precipitation that are required to accurately define and differentiate climates extend no further back than about 1850, the beginning of the historical control period for the IPCC analysis. Earlier climate records of manually read thermometers, rain gauges, and barometers were discontinuous, poorly calibrated, or geographically restricted. For earlier centuries, we depend on phenomena like the price of wheat, or the price of wine, or dates when harbors and rivers became unfrozen. All such records eventually peter out into nothing. To extend climate history back beyond the human time frame, our oldest measured climate records are overlapped with stratigraphic records to create what are called proxy records. In this technique, quantitative measurements of annualized growth systems, like the layers in the bottom of a lake, clamshell rings, ice sheet summits, and tree rings, are used as surrogates for the climate measurements we're really after, for example, average temperature or precipitation. For example, the annual widths of tree rings are strongly correlated to ground moisture during the growing season, which turns out to be much more strongly driven by heat-induced evaporation than by precipitation. This year, we learned that the current megadrought in the U.S. Southwest is the strongest since the record began in 800 CE, and that nearly half of this drought is due to human effects. This tree ring proxy record extends the much shorter record of equivalent meteorological measurements by a factor of 5. The result is a paleomoisture gauge. Another proxy, less useful but more direct, involves the strength of ancient winds. The statistical pattern of grain-sized textures in dune sand are directly related to physical factors such as the threshold wind velocity required to mobilize the grain and the minimum wind speed required to transport it. The result is a paleo wind gauge. A third proxy, the most useful of all for the last million years, involves the succession of annual layers of new ice on the summits of ice caps. Within its solid H2O, the ratios of hydrogen, the H, and oxygen, the O, isotopes, are directly related to the temperatures at which that snow crystallized, giving us two records to cross-reference against one another. The result is a paleothermometer. To reach the South Pole for the first time in 1911, a team led by Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen trekked 1,400 miles southward into trackless whiteness. The ground on which they walked, slept, and huddled their dogs was new-fallen snow, the crystalline mineral phase of water. Beneath that ground was an archive of time that they had no idea they were walking on. Indeed, everywhere beneath our feet, whether on snow or sand or salt or mud, soil, and rock, is evidence of the past. Exploring these stories and sharing them with the world is the central task of geologists. Without their story, we would have no clue whether Earth's present climate is warmer or colder or wetter or drier or windier or calmer than any climates preceding the emergence of human records. Without geologic evidence, we would have no choice but to accept or reject on faith what the designers of the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, tell its visitors. That Earth is just a few thousand years old, and that dinosaurs walked the Earth with humans. Without geology, we Earthlings would be unmoored in time. Cognitive science has revealed to us that short-term memory and long-term memory are stored in separate parts of the human brain. Without our long-term memories, we Earthlings would be like medical patients with amnesia, possessing short-term memories only of recent events. We could not know who we are or where we came from, or who we related to. Luckily, Earth cannot have amnesia, thanks to the durability of long-term memories stored in ice, mud, sand, lime, bones, and rock. This archive allows us to know who we are as a species, and where we came from, and where we're going. For a world preoccupied by climate change, the important part of time is the future. With geology, predictions about what might happen can be constrained by what could happen, knowing what we know about what has happened, based on the hard evidence. Consider this quote from Gordon Wood's The Purpose of the Past, an eminent historian. Quote, "Having a historical sense is to be able to see the participants of the past in a comprehensive way, to see them in the context of their own time, to describe their blindness and folly with sympathy, to recognize the extent to which they were caught up in changing circumstances over which they had no control, and to realize the degree to which they created results they never intended. To know all this about the past and to be able to relate it without anachronistic distortion to the present." Riffing off his paragraph, here's the version for climate change. To understand climate change is to see all the players of the Earth system, air, water, life, rock, metal, in a comprehensive way, without privileging one component over the other. To see each in the context of their own times, whether eons, eras, periods, or epochs, and to see how every fossil group, including humans, was caught up in changing circumstances over which they had little control, due to results they never intended. And most importantly, to see Earth history without the anachronistic distortion of human egos, or the implicit bias of biophilia. My favorite example of anachronistic distortion involves the common semiotic exaggerations of Earth going up in flames as a consequence of carbon emissions. This is chemically impossible because there isn't enough oxygen. More importantly, much of it's non-combustible. Even more importantly, the geohistorical sense elevates the stubborn fact that the present Quaternary period remains in one of the coldest long-term intervals of Earth history. In 1964, the pioneering Danish scientist Willy Dansgaard published a game-changing paper, Stable Isotopes in Precipitation. This allowed the instrumental record of weather to be spliced to the stratigraphic record of ice cores. After two generations of work, the result is a reliable climate history of the global atmosphere based on bubble samples from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets and several tropical ice caps, dating back to about 800,000 years. At ice sheet summits, there is a net deposition of snow every single year. Each creates a stratigraphic layer that will be buried by the next year's snowfall in what is effectively an inverted sedimentary basin. At their summits, the ice sheet flow is remarkably simple, being straight downward until it finally flows outward near the base. Since the early 1950s, we've drilled ice to a depth of over 2 miles, hauled cylinders of it back home to our laboratories, and explored every aspect of those cores with special attention to the thickness of annual layers, ash from distant volcanic eruptions, dust from the land, salt from the sea, soot from our smokestacks, acids from chemical pollution, and the fallout of atomic bombs. And most importantly, bubbles of ancient atmosphere trapped during the conversion of fluffy snow to solid ice. In the lab, this imprisoned ancient air can be released, and the concentration of gases within it can be carefully measured. The half-century of overlap between 1958 and 2008, between air sniffed by the Keeling Curve and air sniffed from bubbles of the Vostok ice core in Antarctica, validates the accuracy of both techniques. This allows us to extend the archive of atmospheric composition back nearly 1 million years. There are 4 main conclusions from the important Vostok core in Antarctica that are relevant to the current climate crisis. First, and most alarmingly, the concentration of CO2 in the modern atmosphere of about 420 parts per million and the concentration of methane of about 2,000 parts per billion. Neither has ever been higher. In former times, the concentration of carbon dioxide varied between only 300 during interglacials and 180 parts per million during glaciations, and the methane varied between 750 and 350 parts per billion. This comparison reveals that modern concentrations are literally off the charts with respect to the last 1 million years. We're definitely into something new. Secondly, Vostok shows a sawtooth pattern at the frequency of about 100,000 years, with periods of gradual cooling about 90,000 years long, followed by abrupt rises in temperature for a few thousand years before the record shifts back again towards colder conditions. 3 variables, reconstructed temperatures, carbon dioxide, and methane, march in lockstep with one another. In every case, the rise in temperature slightly precedes the rise in greenhouse gases being liberated from the deep ocean reservoir. Thirdly, Earth was heading towards its next predictable glacial buildup until, uniquely, that trend was reversed for all 3 indicators that are now off the charts. What this means is that human greenhouse warming has more than reversed a natural cooling and is now pushing Earth out of the long-term ice house state that it's been in for at least 30 million years. Fourth and finally, the precision and scope of ice core analyses is truly astonishing. In one 2022 paper published in Science, Yang and others tracked the integrated primary biological productivity of photosynthesis for the whole Earth over the last 8 glacial cycles of 100,000 years each. The main control on biological productivity, they found out, was not sunlight or temperature, but the fertilizing effect of CO2 content in the atmosphere. Importantly, biological productivity usually starts rising a millennia or more before thermally induced deglaciation, showing that greenhouse warming caused deglaciations rather than vice versa. Also, they proved without doubt that the concentration of CO2 is a brake being applied to photosynthetic productivity, one that keeps Earth from freezing over. All this from bubbles of air trapped in ice. Fluffy snowflakes are beautifully symmetrical crystals of water ice that usually assume the shape of a hexagonal disc. They are solid crystals that grew from water vapor, a gas. Though we don't normally think of ice as a mineral, it easily meets the technical definition of such, being a naturally occurring crystalline solid with a fixed chemical composition that varies within specific limits. A clear crystal of quartz, like those that grow in geodes, is also a mineral. As with ice, the composition of quartz is dominated by the element oxygen. Both are clear and have hexagonal symmetry that can easily grow into elongated prisms. One main difference between the two minerals, quartz and ice, is their melting temperatures. Quartz melts at 650 degrees C, which is unusually low for a silicate. Ice melts at 0 degrees C, which is unusually low for crustal materials. Frozen carbon dioxide, known as dry ice, is also a perfectly respectable mineral, though it does not occur naturally on Earth because its freezing point is minus 78 degrees C. It's common on Mars, where it often snows dry ice. Each layer of snow on the surface of an ice sheet, that is, water snow, is thus a layer of mineral crystals that either fell from the atmosphere or drifted into place. Physically, this is comparable to a layer of quartz-rich dust called loess. In strata, the main difference between water dust and quartz dust is that the snow can quickly recrystallize just a short distance underground, whereas the loess will remain stable unless it's heavily weathered or deeply buried. Glacier ice easily meets the definition of a rock, being an aggregate of one or more minerals. Marble, made from the mineral calcite, is also snow white. Given sufficient heat, pressure, and time, marble will, like glacier ice, also compact, recrystallize, and flow plastically. Age cannot be the criteria for differentiating rock from non-rock. The oldest glacier ice we know of, at 2.7 million years old, is from the Allan Hills of Antarctica. At a minimum, this is three times older than the oldest basalt on Mauna Loa, Earth's largest volcano and largest mountain when measured up from the seafloor. Some Antarctic ice is likely to be 5 million years old, and the shield-shaped ice cap has been there continuously for at least 30 million years. At the surface of the South Pole, the snow is loose, unconsolidated sediment, similar to what you might find on a fine sand beach. Beneath that surface, it becomes sedimentary rock through compression and recrystallization. This is the part sampled by ice cores. When melted and refrozen, the new ice is technically an igneous rock created by a process known as partial melting. When deeply buried, stretched, and sheared by glacier flow, that same ice becomes a metamorphic rock. These latter two types of ice rock are generally avoided for borehole investigations because what the researchers are after is uninterrupted sedimentary layers. At even larger scales, the weight of an ice sheet is enough to flex the crust downward, like a heavy block of ice placed on a large sheet of plywood. To make room for the downward flex, in this analogy, the board pushes the air out of the way. On the actual Earth, it's the soft underbelly of the asthenosphere that yields to flow outward in all directions. As the ice blocks melt and the weight shrinks, both the plywood and the crust flex back up, and the materials beneath them, air and asthenosphere, flow back from whence they came. An ice sheet sliding over bedrock exhibits the same basic physics as one part of Earth's rocky crust sliding over another along a low-angled fault. In both cases, there is grinding, pulverization, scratching, and streamlining. A formerly glaciated land surface can thus be thought of as a fault plane for which the upper block of rock has disappeared, melting in this case the ice, or dissolving in the case of limestone. Ice sheets are the most high-resolution and high-fidelity sedimentary archive we have for reconstructing past climates. Countless others with lower resolution also exist, each with their own special offerings. All provide data that constrain and improve climatic models, on which we become increasingly dependent. One recent review, having two colleagues of mine as co-authors, Ran Feng and Clay Tabor, put it succinctly in their title, Past Climates Inform Our Future. The most iconic paleoclimatic archive is the Grand Canyon of Arizona, which is gawked at by nearly 5 million people a year. Approaching the canyon rim, no one can be adequately prepared for the sublimity they're about to see, a mile-deep chasm sliced downward through the Earth's crust by the Colorado River. With everyone's attention riveted to the canyon walls, they overlook the fact that the same rock lies beneath their feet in the underground. The proverbial book of time for such sedimentary rock is accessible by drill cores nearly everywhere. Each of the canyon's sedimentary layers is analogous to a single page of a very long book. Just as each page in a novel describes different people, places, and events, each stratum exposed in the walls of the canyon has its own color, texture, strength, and fossil content that can be interpreted. Each attribute of each layer tells its own story, sometimes sharply set off from the rest, sometimes blended in, the grand total of which is the epic of Earth history. It turns out that climate change is an enormously important part of that epic, at the Grand Canyon and elsewhere. From such rocks, we learn of times known as greenhouse states, when tropical lushness extended to both poles, or times of ice house, when lands at high latitude were smothered by snow and ice. We learn of times when the land beneath what is now the southwestern United States was so hyper-arid that a sea of sand dunes the size of the Sahara produced waves of stark beauty. Waves of a sea that fossilized into a geologic formation called the Navajo Sandstone. We learn of times when drenching monsoon rains and dry season aridity painted the landscape in rusty reds and yellows. Layer after layer, these individual stories sum upward in space and time to reveal a narrative of constant climate change. Though ice cores hold the archive of highest resolution, and though the Grand Canyon holds the archive of greatest fame, the black layer-cake terrain of the Siberian trap rock holds the key to the most potent underground climate event in life history. The word trap comes from the Swedish trappen, which means staircase. As used by early geologists, the word was attached to thick sequences of dark lava flows that, when downcut by rivers and etched by erosion, gave a landscape a stair-step profile. Each of these thick sequences marks a place where great rift fractures opened up in the Earth's crust, through which erupted primitive magmas derived directly from the mantle. They gushed up to flood the land surface, not with water, but with vast lakes of molten lava that hardened into flat plains of a solid rock called basalt. These flood basalts come from what are known as large igneous provinces, LIPs for short. About 252 million years ago, the supercontinent of Pangaea began to rift apart. Vertical fissures opened up, allowing the Siberian traps to flood an area the size of the conterminous United States with steaming, smoking, degassing lava. If you look closely at a sample, you'll see the vesicles or fossilized bubbles from which the gas was vented. Combining theory and lab analyses, competing research teams of geochemists agree that the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere increased nearly sixfold from about 425 parts per million to over 2,500 parts per million within an interval of about 75,000 years. In this heavily carbonized atmosphere, the climate heated rapidly to super greenhouse conditions and the ocean acidified to become anoxic. The result was Earth's most deadly extinction of the fossil record, with about 90% of marine species and about 70% of terrestrial vertebrates dying out. The trap rock formations are only one archive of this event. Far better ones with higher resolution were deposited in contemporary lakes and seas. The longest uninterrupted and continuous archive of Earth history comes from the floors of the abyssal oceans, where the record extends back to about 200 million years old. There, the dark, cold, soft mud of the ocean bottom transitions downward into firmer, unconsolidated sediment that transitions further downward into sedimentary rock. Sampling this record for the U.S. Ocean Drilling Program is the task of the ship Joides Resolution, which can drill in water up to 27,000 feet deep to obtain cores up to several thousand feet long. These are deep enough to reveal the 50-million-year-long punctuated cooling of our planet from its previous greenhouse state into its current ice house state, and higher up in the core, the comings and goings of repeated glacier advances during the last 2.6 million years of the Pleistocene epoch. Other paleoclimatic archives are spectacular in their own way. I've seen razor-thin laminations in the Green River Formation in Wyoming between 54 and 48 million years ago that are so high fidelity they can reveal changes in the seasons caused by Earth's orbital variations. I've seen glacial scratches and scrapes on boulders embedded in mud rock near Lake Huron that confirm Earth's first well-known episode of glaciation about 2.4 billion years ago. The oldest underground archive of sedimentary rock on Earth is the Jack Hills Formation in Australia. This sandstone contains stream-rounded grains of zircon so resistant that they've been recycled from older rocks several times. One tiny grain the size of a period at the end of a sentence contains an even tinier defect called an inclusion. Isotopic analysis of water from within that inclusion proves that the Earth was covered by liquid water as early as 4.1 billion years ago. Another, even older zircon grain, dating to 4.4 billion years old, is the oldest earthly object known, older than any rock. To me, it's ironic that the oldest thing on our planet is not some immense resistant block of crust, but a tiny speck of sand. Well, similarly, the oldest living things on Earth is the genome of a tiny microbe, against which the giant elephants and blue whales are young upstarts.